Welcome back, Michael Warren Thomas. It's the Grapevine, SaverLife.com, and it is winter pruning season. It's also time to plan for some of the conferences that are normally held this time of the year for in the wine industry, and one of those is called BEV New York. It's an acronym for Business Enology and Viticulture in New York, and Cornell is one of the key organizations behind this. You can go to bevny.org and find more details of the program and some background on it. It's going to be March 3rd through the 5th, each day devoted to that topic. The first day, business; the second day, enology; third day, viticulture. So the first day, March 3rd, and again, you can register, March 3rd, you can register online. And it will be a virtual conference this year. They're going to have a couple session topics on the business end of wine and wineries, how to leverage technology to accelerate sales, which in a period when online sales are really important and growing that segment of your business, makes sense. They'll be doing a session on that, and also business model adaptation in a COVID-19 impacted environment. Speakers from here, also one from California, the California Wine Institute, Jim Treisice, coming back to the area. He's the president of Wine America, formerly founder and three-decade-plus executive director here in our area for New York Wine and Grape Foundation. Several people from Cornell. Good mix of different people. They're also going to have a plenary session on wine industry business and policy update. During this pandemic, this will be very interesting, and this conference is geared to the industry. It's not a conference geared to consumers, but if you or someone you know is thinking about maybe getting a job in the industry or starting a winery or anything like that, this might be the perfect conference. And in fact, it's online, maybe makes it easier to participate in. The second day, Enology, is going to have four panelists talking about picking grapes. It says it seems like an easy enough question, but growers and winemakers have lots of factors to consider that have nothing to do with the rain forecasts and full tanks. This panel hopes to provide some tools for each party to better communicate their goals and fears for the grapes and subsequent wine harvest, so the harvest can be as productive and stress-free as possible. And again, there's Tina Hazlett from Sawmill Creek Vineyards, Peter Martini from Martini Vineyards, Mario Maza Vineyards, that's toward Lake Erie, and Rich Olson Harbich from Bedell Cellars, Long Island. So Sawmill Creek Vineyards is purely a grape-growing operation. They have no winery. And so, but they sell to our local wineries, and which is a different business model than growing your own grapes, and also the question of when to pick, when are they ripe, when you're working within the business, a winery that's growing its own grapes, then. Those decisions are kind of in-house and still maybe fraught with back and forth of, it's too dangerous to wait to pick. We need to pick earlier. Dangerous in terms of the grapes losing quality or something. But also some of these vineyard managers like Peter Martini and Martini Vineyards, they grow not only their own grapes, but also grapes for other wineries. So they are kind of under pressure from, you know, within their winery, but also other wineries that may have different criteria and different goals, different strategies. So this will be, I think, pretty fascinating. And Tina Haslett is, she'll be fun to listen to. She's great in, I've just been doing this for many, many years. I look forward to hearing what she says, and because they work with quite a few different wineries, some of them for decades. Again, it's not only picking the grapes, but one sideline to this might be, maybe they'll do this next year, what grapes to plant. That's a whole other issue in terms of weather and climate change and demands of the consumers, etc. But this session is when should we pick the grapes? So that's March 4th. March 5th, it's viticulture is the theme for the day. They'll have, sort of the background on the theme, what climate change might mean to our vines and lakes. In New York, there's always been a strong relationship between water and grapevines, in particular the lakes and rivers that our vineyards are located close to, or the ocean in the case of Long Island, which help to moderate the climate, make it possible to grow many of the varieties that we grow. Our speakers will bring both international and local perspectives to this session, with information coming from both academic and production experience. So the topics for that day, March 5th, again, a virtual conference, how climate change is impacting Germany's vineyards. Someone from Geisenheim will be here, as well as a winemaker, general manager from Weingut Kohler Ruppecht from Karlstadt, Germany. And then the next topic, lake health and water. Oh, by the way, I think I heard a couple days ago that this was one of the first, maybe the first year that no German wineries produced ice wine. It didn't get cold enough to do that. It may have happened in the past. I haven't researched it, just heard about this, but that's probably one of the things I'll be talking about. Second topic for March 5th, lake health and water quality in a changing climate. Dr. Lisa Kleckner, director of the Finger Lakes Institute, will be doing that. Again, lots of cool things going on. There are other tracks within the BEV conference. So that was one track. Also, they have one on the challenges of building an outstanding wine brand. For the business day, new thoughts on cold stabilization in wine for the winemaking day, and integrated pest management topics for Eastern vineyards and the viticulture day. The third track, the next frontier, the New York wine brand in the context of the global market. For business day, analogy will be materials other than stainless steel and how new red options from Europe. And then the winemaking track, or viticulture track, new practices and technologies to improve vineyard management. So, again, kind of three different tracks over 3 days within those subject headlines. And you can go to bevny.org and get more details. Should be a fascinating conference. And again, you can participate online, of course. You have to participate online. Also, Cornell put out a couple months ago an article about spotted lanternfly. Hans Walter Peterson did this. Team leader in the viticulture extension specialist, talking about the fact that egg clusters were found of the spotted lanternfly in Ithaca, just south of the Cornell campus. And while he says that they're hopeful that the investigators were able to get all the egg cases, that is highly unlikely. As good as the investigators are, the problem is that these egg cases are deposited in some cases 40 to 60 feet high in trees, and not necessarily in the tree that is often associated with spotted lanternfly, the tree of heaven. So virtually impossible to discover all the egg cases, unfortunately, just because of the height at which these are laid in trees. You can't see them when they're 60 feet up in a tree, even with binoculars. And people at University of Pennsylvania have tried that. Penn State. But it really didn't work. So we'll see. Maybe they did get them all. I would say, again, my personal opinion is there's a close to 0% chance that they got them all, unfortunately. Wooded area, again, they lay them, these egg cases that are camouflaged, so you can't see them, for one thing. You may not see it when it's 4 feet off the ground right in front of you. Good luck seeing it at 60 feet in the air. So the article goes on to say kind of things that might be helpful over this dormant season. First and foremost, become familiar or refamiliarize yourself with spotted lanternfly egg cases, what they look like. And as he says, as we move into the winter pruning season, it'll be important to keep an eye open as we're walking past barns and line posts, fences, etc., where the spotted lanternfly can lay its eggs, which is almost anywhere, in parentheses. The egg cases can look like splotches of mud or dirt, so they can be difficult to see. And there's a link to a YouTube video from the IPM program. Also, it says become familiar with quarantine requirements. This is not COVID quarantine. This is the quarantine requirements related to the spotted lanternfly, specifically Pennsylvania. So be familiar with these quarantine requirements for traffic coming from areas already with established spotted lanternfly populations, anywhere outlined in red in the current map below. And I'm happy to send you this link, or you can find it on Cornell's website pretty easily, I think. Be sure to ask vendors, visitors, or others who are coming from those areas or who visited there to be sure that they thoroughly inspect their vehicles and loads before they come into New York State. We'll get back to that. Also, become familiar with insecticides that are labeled for use on grapes for spotted lanternfly. As you are making decisions about pest management material purchases this winter, this might be something to take into consideration. The materials that have been approved for use in New York on spotted lanternfly are already labeled for other pests and grapes, so you may already have one or more of these products on hand. If you tend not to use insecticides in most years, it would still be good to know what the options are in case spotted lanternfly shows up in your vineyard next year. And one of the vineyards in Pennsylvania that's been dealing with this said that they went from 4 insecticide treatments a year in a normal year to 14 to try to treat spotted lanternfly, and really I think it didn't really work that well, even with that many additions to the spray program. So that is one of the reasons that people are so worried about this. Back to the quarantine, these egg cases are laid in October, November. They don't hatch out until April, May range. So unfortunately, there are lots of visitors from Pennsylvania that come to Finger Lakes wineries and to the region. And so, if they're coming this time of the year and the egg cases are on their cars, and there's so many of these spotted lanternflies in parts of Pennsylvania that it's likely that there's some on cars from those areas. If they come this time of the year and visit for a week and then go home, doesn't matter. The egg cases stay in their cars. And it's the visitors in April and May that we really need to be worried about, because there the potential is for those eggs to hatch while the car is sitting in a hotel parking lot in the Finger Lakes, or while it's sitting in a winery for a few hours. It's kind of crazy maybe to think about, but that's how this is, one of the key ways this is going to spread. So it's odd to be talking about another a different kind of quarantine. Already there are something like 26 or maybe 28 counties in Pennsylvania that are under quarantine, where the restrictions on shipping things out of nursery stock in particular out of those counties, and expensive inspection protocols that have to be adhered to. So it's costing Pennsylvania businesses tens of millions of dollars already, and that's why we're so worried about it here in New York State. So you can follow Cornell's work on this, and those scouts will be back out in April and May looking for the juveniles that may be hatching out of these egg cases. They will not be easy to find because they move fast, they're small, and they eat like 70 different kinds of trees and shrubs. So you can't look for just one plant and expect to that all the juveniles will be on that plant or whatever's, you know, tree of heaven, for example, which they do seem to prefer, but not as much at the juvenile stage. So this is something to be proactive and be aggressive in trying to control this in 2021. And better news, it seems like each issue of Wine Spectator that comes out, there's information and accolades for a couple of the international winemakers who are making wine now in the Finger Lakes. And the one of the recent ones was on Argentina. This was the December 31st through January 15th issue, which had the top 100 in it, which Paul Hobbs was in the top 100, something like number 50 for his Pinot Noir. And the article about Argentina featured in the evaluations his wines and from Vino Cabos, which is his winery in Argentina making Malbec, and for now for quite a few years. So the scores were pretty fantastic for his Malbecs, and some of the best in the for the category. What they said about his Pinot Noir, he was 51 on the Wine Spectator top 100. By the way, Ford Sellers was, I think, 31 on this list. So congratulations to them for their Riesling. But for Paul Hobbs, they say located in the far northwestern corner of Sonoma County, gently sloping Gold Rock Vineyard is one of the most recent and best additions to Paul Hobbs' impressive stable of Pinot Noirs. It's a sunny upland site that's rich with loamy soils of Gold Ridge formation, in which many of Sonoma's best vines are rooted. 2018 vintage featured moderate temperatures and a long harvest that ranks as one of the best in recent memory for California Pinot Noir. 800 cases made. So, but the scores for his Malbecs were tremendous, and it seems like, you know, each time that they do this, his wines are in the top very top of the category. And the so it's a reminder of the quality of these international winemakers that have chosen to make wine in the Finger Lakes. So Kim Marcus has recommended wines from Argentina. Number one on that list, top wines, Vino Cabos from Paul Hobbs. And it's a score of 96, $100 per bottle. And then numbers are 1, 2, 3, 5. Numbers 5 and 6 are also Vino Cabos, scoring 95 points, two other Malbecs, and $100 a bottle. So three of the top six are Vino Cabos from Paul Hobbs. And, again, that's all kinds of international investment have gone into Argentina. And Paul Hobbs was one of the three, they call it the three flying winemakers, back in the late 1980s, one from France, one from Italy, and Paul from California, flew into Argentina and worked with wineries there. And Paul ended up starting his own winery also. And in just a few years, they went from tearing out vines, tearing out Malbec. The Argentinian wineries had kind of given up on Malbec. They figured they would just plant Cabernet and Merlot and Chardonnay and, you know, be like the rest of the world. These three flying winemakers changed their minds, and they started not only leaving the Malbec, but planting more of it. In fact, when Paul went to work for it was Zapata, maybe I forget the name of the winery, but the winery that he was hired to make Chardonnay, consulting on that. That was his first job in Argentina, and he asked him if he could make some Malbec, and they said no. But he actually made a couple barrels anyway, and the story was that a bunch of international wine media came to the winery and tasted the Chardonnays. I guess liked them, but when they asked if there were other things they could taste, I guess the owner of the winery said no, and Paul said, well, there's actually, there is a Malbec that he'd made, even though he was told not to, and it was the Malbec which kind of won the day with that group of international wine media. And in a period of a few years, things changed dramatically. A tremendous amount of investment has gone into Argentina, and yet he is still got three of the six top wines here. And if it was this article, I think it was this article, somewhere I read recently, it was a description of Paul, and he had, I think he has a new winemaker, a new vineyard manager in Argentina, and they had done a kind of a complete overhaul of their practices. And this is, in spite of the fact he was already getting top scores and some of the top wines in Argentina, and yet, he knows that to keep moving forward, you have to keep innovating, and that's one of the reasons that I'm so excited he's making wine in the Finger Lakes, making Riesling, he'll bring that drive to innovate, and it will it'll provide ideas for wineries here. It will it brings international attention to the region. So again, scores of 96, 95 points, which are fairly unusual in Wine Spectator. And again, for Malbec. And then the other winemaker who has come here, in this case from France, is Louis Barol. And he continues to get tremendous scores. He's a partner in Forge Cellars, which had the highest, I think the highest ranking ever for a Finger Lakes wine in the top 100 of Wine Spectator. They're Riesling Classique. And the description in Wine Spectator says French winemaker Louis Barol of Gigandas' Chateau Saint-Côme set his sight abroad, teaming up with local Richard Rainey to create Forge Cellars and make single vineyard Pinot Noir and Riesling wines in New York's Finger Lakes region. This bottling is a blend of hand-harvested Riesling grapes from 16 different vineyards of contracted growers along the east side of Seneca Lake. Using techniques uncommon in the Finger Lakes, the duo did a whole cluster pressing followed by months-long fermentation with indigenous yeasts in mostly neutral oak as well as stainless steel, 4,000 cases made. So this is their biggest production Riesling at Forge Cellars, the Classique. They do a lot of single vineyard bottlings, but this one, they're going to blend of 16 vineyards and scored 31 points, number 31 on Wine Spectator Top 100, only New York State wine in this year's Top 100. And so the following issue of Wine Spectator, which was basically this January 31st through February 28th, they come out weeks early. So, you know, today is January 31st, but I got this about a week ago. James Molesworth, he reviewed the wines from the Rhone Valley and had the Gigandas, those wines of Chateau Saint-Côme are in the southern Rhone, and the top 2018 other southern Rhone, the Chateau Neuf de Pape is also in the southern Rhone, and but a different region, different part of it than Chateau Saint-Côme. The Chateau Saint-Côme wines, 96 points, 95 points, 95 points. In fact, kind of identical scores to Paul Hobbs. And this, so three of the top four other Southern Rhone wines are from Chateau Saint-Côme. And those scores, other than one Chateau Neuf de Pape that got 97 points, similar to other Rhone, Southern Rhone wines. So, again, we have some amazing international winemakers who have chosen to invest in the Finger Lakes, and that is the good news for our region, because it brings techniques, it brings experience, it brings innovation and new blood to our region, which is a great thing. For years, Dr. Constantine Frank, the winery has been one of the key reasons that we have quite a variety of international winemakers now in the Finger Lakes, because they brought those young winemakers as part of their winemaking team. And for decades, the winery has had a mix of winemakers on their team from around the world, usually one from Germany, from Australia or New Zealand, one from France. There'd be, we have a team of four or five winemakers, and a number of these winemakers have stayed and have become some of the best here in our area. Several with their own wineries. Peter Weiss most recently opened his winery, but Johannes Reinhardt, who worked for many years after Dr. Frank at Anthony Road, now has Chemeter Wines, and Morten Hallgren, who he is, of course, he and Lisa launched Ravines, but he was brought to the Finger Lakes by Dr. Frank originally. So it is this international group of winemakers has brought a lot to our region, and it's exciting to see where it's going to go. And it's kind of ironic that the spotted lanternfly should show up just as, really just as Paul Hobbs will be releasing his first Riesling. He's produced a small batches in the past, but this is the first time that it'll have significant amount of Riesling to distribute, and I expect it'll probably be released at some point later this year. Not sure when, but we'll let you know. If you want details on anything you heard me mention, send me an email, michael@saverlife.com. And if you want any links, et cetera, and more comments and suggestions, michael@saverlife.com. Hope you enjoy the winter weather. I got to get out and do some pruning of my apple trees when we get a mild day or two, but been a cold week. Not dangerously cold for the vines. There was a note Gene Pierce referred to from Cornell's newsletter for grape growers that it seems like the grapes generally do pretty well below zero even, and even, you know, down to 10, 12, 13 degrees below zero. It's when you get into 17, 18, 19 degrees below zero is when really significant damage occurs, which has happened a couple of times. Once, several years ago, on the eve of Valentine's Day, we had a mild winter except for one night, and it was that night, February 13th, or the damage was done, really, I think, on February 14th. On Valentine's Day, with temperatures that went down around minus 18. So the cold weather we've had this week isn't a problem. It's if we get some really severe cold at some point. So have a great day. Be back next Saturday with Gardening Restaurants and Discover the Finger Lakes here at SaverLife.com.